Several weeks ago, I spoke on the topic of developing your spiritual gifts, and I don't know if you've had time to think about your own particular gifts, and I'm not here to judge you if you haven't. But while we may wonder whether or not we even have any spiritual gifts at all, today I'd like to show a requirement that all of us must develop. You may call it a gift. I suppose that would be appropriate. I would say that it's a required spiritual gift, and more than that, it's a Christian principle, and this particular Christian principle that I'm going to speak about today and related principles that are kind of brothers and cousins and related to this particular principle are an absolute requirement of us. Between now and the Passover, I would like to encourage you to spend some time and thought and reflect as to how effective you are in the application of this very important principle. This quality of Christian living has many related components, which we'll be talking about prior to the Holy Day season. So I think no matter what else is given during the rest of the preparation time prior to the Passover, it's going to kind of fit into the cog of this particular wheel today. To show you how important this is for us, I'm going to tell you that this single principle has saved the lives of countless millions and perhaps even billions of people and is responsible for shaping the history of mankind. So if you could tap into this principle, which has been so effective, wouldn't that make you feel good? That you're doing something appropriate and godly and right? Because it is mightier than massive armies. It's more important than any kind of wealth or accumulation of riches. And it's more powerful than any physical force that has any lasting effect on mankind. Even some of the lasting, impressive natural forces that we've seen this past week in Japan and affecting even our part of the world over on the west coast of America. What a tragedy. But over time, this particular principle, I will submit to you today that if you can inculcate this to its fullest extent, is going to be so much more important than any kind of physical force that you could see exerted upon mankind. It is a quality that is in such short supply that no matter how much is accrued, there will never be a surplus of it, and no matter how much is produced, will never be devalued. And it's offered to all of us free of charge. Before I tell you what this clue is, or this principle is, let me give you a clue, and it's found in Isaiah chapter 58 and verse 9. And then I'd like you to allow your imagination to direct you as to where this might apply on an international basis. Just where, actually, this particular passage describes the antithesis of the topic of my sermon today. But think about where this might be applied in the world today. This is the very famous chapter in Isaiah on fasting and how to fast for the appropriate reasons and the right kind of godly fast. So I'm not going to talk about fasting, and that's not the point. The point is extracting a principle that is rampant in the world today and is the antithesis of the vital spiritual Christian principle that I speak of today. In Isaiah 58 and verse 9, it says, "Then you shall call and the Lord will answer. You shall cry and he will say, here I am." Now here it is, the antithesis of the principle I'm speaking of. If you take away the yoke from your midst, you know, interesting. Sometimes people can enslave themselves. They can put yokes on themselves. They can withhold themselves. They can make themselves servants, as it were. But God says, if you'll take away the yoke from your midst, here it is, the pointing of the finger and speaking wickedness. This might not lead you directly to what I'm speaking about today, but I can tell you that it is the very antithesis of the Christian principle that we want to inculcate in our lives, a principle which has shaped the history of mankind. It really has, for the better. It's been an incredible force throughout history, although it's something that's so simple that we probably rarely think of it in that kind of expression. In our world today, There are nations, many of them, that live with resentment, with hatred, and envy as the motivation of their populace. And this goes back, perhaps in some cases, thousands of years. This has been the motivating force of these peoples, and I encourage you, I'm not going to identify them, you can think about where they lie on the globe today. But these individual groups of peoples and nations can only think sometimes of the past, supposed injustices that have been perpetrated upon them, and their belief systems hold them back from being productive citizens of the world. And it would be so far better for these nations and millions of people in the world today to focus on, okay, what can I do to help myself? And if they were just to simply do that and leave all this baggage of resentment and envy and hatred and enmity, if they were just to put all of that away, how much more productive would these peoples be? You know, we look around the world today, and you know the history of Israel. You know the history of the United States of America and the British Commonwealth and, you know, all of these nations that have been, you know, spanning the globe and have had worldwide influence and had had tremendous wealth and riches bestowed upon them by God Almighty. And we've talked about the United States and British Commonwealth peoples in prophecy, how they've been blessed and how they've done this and that. And, you know, you look at the United States, and even today we have so many wonderful blessings that come from the earth and so many blessings that have been given to us, and we're situated appropriately, and we have natural wealth and minerals and resources and, you know, yet undiscovered and untapped wealth that could sustain us for hundreds and yea thousands of years. Even in this nation now, at our current population, if we had the right policies and we had the right attitude and that sort of thing, we still have so many blessings. But it doesn't mean that all the rest of the nations of the world have been left out. It's just sometimes that one of the things that has really held people back is themselves. You know, pointing the finger at somebody else and accusing somebody else of all of the ills of your life does nothing for you, whether you're an individual or whether you're a group of people, cities, towns, nations. And yet I submit to you that there are people today on our earth that live with resentment, hatred, and envy as the motivation behind them. And even in fact, that's probably the primary religious focus that they have in their lives. Their belief systems hold them back from being productive citizens. It hasn't been that they don't have resources that they could take advantage of or wealth that they could take advantage of. It's just that they simply choose to focus on something else. It's a powerful force that motivates them for evil and wrong, and it holds the world back as well. And it will culminate at the return of Jesus Christ, as we know. In Galatians chapter 5 and verses 19 through 21, we see the embodiment of this slavery and this bondage and this yoke that people willingly place themselves under because they focus on these works of the flesh, which Paul talk about, which again are the antithesis or the opposite of what the topic that I'm going to speak about today. Paul begins in Galatians 5 and verse 19 by saying, "The works of the flesh are evident, which are adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lewdness, idolatry, and sorcery." Now, those are things that, you know, all those first things are things that we can look at and we can see. You know, this is the result of wrong thinking and wrong behavior, right? But then there are other things that were kind of hidden, and they're under the surface. But you look out into the world today, and you will see millions of people motivated by hatred, contentions, jealousies, outbursts of wrath, selfish ambitions, dissensions. Whole nations motivated by envy and all these things. And you can actually see the results of this national thinking and attitude that hold millions of people back. And again, it's not because they don't have opportunity. It's not because they don't have access to blessings of the earth or anything else on this planet. I mean, take a look at this horrible event in Japan. You know, the Japanese people recovered from World War II. They recovered. They're an island. They have almost no natural resources, but they're the second or third most important economy in the world. How did they do it? Because, you know, they haven't been perfect as a nation, we could say, But in a sense, they went through a time of national repentance after World War II. The emperor, you know, finally decided that he would not claim that he was God. And as a people, they didn't hold any resentment towards what had happened to them, or at least not in a national sense or a great sense. Two of their cities were bombed to smithereens by, you know, the United States of America, and nuclear holocaust was visited upon them. But they came back, and they have been extremely productive. I think not a Christian nation, but a model nation from the standpoint of not having this enmity and hatred and anger. And, I mean, they've been a tremendous example for the rest of the world in that way. But there are other nations that just look and point the finger and blame others continually. Whole nations and groups of people do this. And you know that this is true. But when these carnal qualities are expressed in excess, and we all have them, don't we? And all nations to some degree or another have them. That is hatred, contentions, jealousies, wrath, selfish ambition, dissensions, and envy. It really becomes a matter of degree. And when that becomes the mass motivation of a people, then they're headed for destruction. So these kinds of motives always suppress ability. They always suppress the development of people. And they hold people back because they focus on anger and resentment and hostility. And virtually every day in the news, you can see these attitudes expressed. And even in our nation, you see it expressed, not to a national extent, thankfully, but you see it expressed in current events. People who think they've been wronged, people who hold grudges, and they have the ability to just hold that in forever, it seems. Whether you're an individual, a group, or a nation, you will never progress very far in life by holding resentment and anger and looking back and blaming somebody else for your ills. Blaming somebody else. All of this is the antithesis of what I'm speaking on today. Now, on the other hand, the principle that I'm describing today embodies all of the qualities contained in the expressions of the fruit of the Spirit. It's such a big thing that all of the fruit of God's Holy Spirit is expressed in verse 22 in this one single Christian attitude. The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such there is no law. And as I said before, it is a quality that is in such short supply that you can never accrue too much of it. And no matter how much you accrue in your life through your spiritual development, it will never be devalued, in a sense. It will always be one of the most valuable qualities that you can possess. And on an associated theme, if you, as an individual, only look back with anger, resentment, hostility towards a wrong or a supposed wrong, how you were harmed, whether it's true or not, I can tell you this, it will hurt only you in the long run. Well, I could say that it's only going to hurt you, but none of us really live in a vacuum. We simply don't. No man is an island, as it says. And if you, in yourself, and I'm speaking to individuals, of course, if you bring into your being anger, resentment, hostility, envy, pointing the finger at others, and you maintain that hurt, it is going to not only hurt you, but it will hurt people around you. But so powerful is the principle that I'm talking about today that it has, as I said earlier, literally saved millions, perhaps billions of lives, and changed the course of history. And so I'm going to submit to you this today. You know, we know that we are born to become kings and priests in the world tomorrow, but what we do right now is very, very important. You have the power to shape history, to change lives, to affect generations throughout hundreds of years, and leave a powerful legacy for those in your family and those around you. Turn to the book of Exodus in chapter 34. all of these qualities expressed in the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, gentleness, faithfulness, self-control, all of these are captured by one single Christian principle, and this principle is mentioned in Exodus 34. And this is right after Moses got angry, and Moses threw the tablets of stone down on the people of Israel, and there was a great plague that went through, and thousands of people lost their lives, etc., etc. So Moses went back up to get the second edition of a very limited edition book, right? And the Lord said to Moses, cut two tablets of stone like the first ones, and I will write on these tablets the words that were on the first tablets, which you broke. Moses got angry. So be ready in the morning and come up in the morning to Mount Sinai and present yourself to me there on the top of the mountain. And no man shall come up with you, and let no man be seen throughout the mountain. Let neither flocks nor herds feed before that mountain. So he cut two tablets of stone like the first ones. Then Moses rose early in the morning and went up to Mount Sinai as the Lord had commanded him, and he took in his hand the two tablets of stone. Now the Lord descended in the cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of the Lord. And the Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord God, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abounding in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, by no means clearing the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and upon the children's children to the third and fourth generation. You know, that is the lasting effect of iniquity or sin, to the third and the fourth generation sometimes. Some problems can be so great that they can last. They can be forgiven from a spiritual and a supernatural standpoint, but sometimes sin can have a lasting effect. It can go on and on and on throughout generations. So Moses, he was wise. He was a lot wiser now. He realized what had happened just 24 hours before. So he made haste, and he bowed his head toward the earth and worshiped, and then he said, if now I have found grace in your sight, O Lord, let my Lord, I pray, go among us. Even though we are a stiff-necked people, and pardon our iniquity and sin, and take us as your inheritance. This wasn't the only time that this had happened, but Moses intervened on behalf of Israel at this time and other times and asked God to spare the people of Israel. Moses' expression of mercy and forgiveness prevented the annihilation of an entire race of people. It saved millions of lives. Now, later on, let's turn to Numbers chapter 14. Israel was poised to, at that point, later on, just a few weeks later, to enter the land of Canaan. But they weren't really ready, as we see. Numbers 14 shows that they were upset. They had an evil report from some spies. We know what happened. And they cried and wept all night. They're all upset. They're afraid they're going to be annihilated. They didn't have any faith. They said in verse 2, if only we had died in the land of Egypt, or if only we had died in this wilderness, why has the Lord brought us to this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and children should become victims, etc., etc., etc. So they were all upset. Verse 6 shows that Joshua and Caleb intervened and said, we can do this. You know, this is not going to be a big problem. And for all of that positive attitude that they expressed, verse 10 shows that they were rewarded with a opportunity to be stoned. So much for a positive attitude. I'm sure that Dr. Norman Vincent Peale would have been shocked by the hostility amongst the children of Israel, or other practitioners of having a positive attitude. Verse 11, then the Lord said to Moses, how long will these people reject me? And how long will they not believe me with all the signs which I have performed among them? I will strike them with a pestilence and disinherit them, and I'll make of you a nation greater and mightier than they. And Moses said to the Lord, then the Egyptians will hear it, for by your might you brought these people up from among them, and they will tell it to the inhabitants of the land. They have heard that you, Lord, are among these people, that you, Lord, are seen face to face, and your cloud stands above them, and you go before them in the pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. Now, if you kill these people as one man, Then the nations which have heard of your fame will speak, saying, because the Lord was not able to bring this people the land which he swore to give them, therefore he killed them in the wilderness. And now I pray, let the power of my Lord be great, just as you have spoken, saying, the Lord is long-suffering and abundant in mercy, forgiving iniquity and transgression, but he by no means clears the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers of the children on the third and fourth generation. Aha! You see, Moses had learned from what is written in Exodus 34, and he was able to give these words right back. So there was a penalty that extended for a while, and yet the people were preserved. But just as they had said, you know, oh, that we would die in the wilderness, and so they did. Those ones did die in the wilderness. And so there was a penalty, but it wasn't as great as the ultimate penalty that God proposed. In verse 20, it says, then the Lord said, I have pardoned according to your word, but truly as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord, because all these men who have seen my glory and the signs which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness and have put me to the test now these 10 times and have not heeded my voice, they certainly shall not see the land which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who rejected me see it. But my servant Caleb, because he has a different spirit in him, and has followed me fully, I will bring him in into the land where he went, and his descendants shall inherit it. Brethren, mercy and forgiveness are godly qualities that God imposes no quantitative limits on our ability to accrue. Moses' expression is a true testament of somebody that had a spiritual mind and was converted by God, because we have numerous examples in which he was pushed to the limit by the millions of people that he led out of the wilderness, led out of Egypt into the wilderness and for 40 years in the wilderness. And I submit to you that mercy and forgiveness are the foremost qualities in shaping the history of mankind. Because had this happened, I mean, everything, had God just wiped them out, everything would have been changed. There might not have been 12 tribes as we understand them today. It might have been a totally different historical aspect. To show how history would be shaped by forgiveness and mercy, God had his prophet Hosea do something that we would consider very strange and improper and actually kind of weird. If you'll turn to Hosea, you can read the first chapter. I'm not going to read it today, but God had Hosea marry an unfaithful woman, and an unfaithful woman who is a harlot. And he had him do this for the reason of showing exactly how Israel treated God. And it was, I mean, when you think about the requirement of this prophet, it is a strange thing, but he's told in the first chapter, he's announced, I mean, we don't know exactly how it came down or how he was instructed to do this, but he was told in order so that people could understand how God felt about what Israel did to him after everything that he had done for her, he was told to marry an unfaithful woman, have children by her. And throughout the prophecy of Hosea, the unfaithfulness of this nation of Israel, the 12 tribes, is shown through its history from the time of its establishment as a people until the time of the end and till Christ's return. Of course, prophecy being dual, it has a lot of application towards the time period in which Hosea lived just prior to the time that they went into captivity, which was about 790 BC or about 70 years prior to Israel going into captivity, being taken off by the Ninevites. And one of the greatest indictments of all against Israel and Ephraim and Judah and Manasseh are mentioned. Ephraim, Israel, and Manasseh or Judah are mentioned here. One of the greatest indictments against them is what? Their lack of mercy. Their lack of mercy. Hosea chapter 4 and verse 1. Hear the word of the Lord, you children of Israel, for the Lord brings a charge against the inhabitants of the land. There is no truth or mercy or knowledge of God in the land. Knowledge of God and a merciful approach go hand in hand. And at least one thing you can say about general Christianity, okay, the Christianity that has been spread abroad, even if it's been done, including all of the falsehoods of Christmas and Easter and everything else, the one thing you can say is that at least they understand this principle of forgiveness and mercy. At least that has been shed abroad everywhere. I mean, emanating from the work of many English theologians and many American preachers, at least that message has gotten through. And there is some common ground. At least people understand that that has been one of the hallmarks, at least one of the things that Christianity is famous for. Merciful approach, an attitude of mercy, knowledge of God and mercy are synonymous. It goes on, by swearing and lying, killing and stealing and committing adultery, they break all restraint with bloodshed upon bloodshed. Therefore the land will mourn, and everyone who dwell there will waste away, while the beasts of the field and the birds of the air, even the fish of the sea, will be taken away. Now, I'm not saying that in this land we should be soft-headed, or national approach should be extending mercy to people who don't deserve it. I mean, obviously the New Testament and the clarification of the law is that when people repent, you should extend mercy and forgiveness to them. But until they come to that point in their lives, I hope that we all understand that fine line. You know, there is a matter of we have to be big-minded as Christians, and we have to be willing to accept individuals' forgiveness or individuals' repentance, but we must do that at the time when they are truly repentant. We must give them mercy and forgiveness at that particular time. All of this that is cited by Hosea is a result of lack of forgiveness, mercy, and the knowledge of God generally, of course, as it mentions. You know, sometimes it's a result of people trying to obtain justice for themselves, being selfish, and realizing that in this land, you know, sometimes justice often does elude the perpetrators of crimes and wrongdoing and that sort of thing. And so there isn't the knowledge of God that is present and that is enacted upon that would actually bring them back to normal. Hosea chapter 6 and verse 5 says, and this was true from a historical standpoint, "Therefore I have hewn them by the prophets, I have slain them by the words of my mouth, and your judgments are like light that goes forth. For I desire mercy and not sacrifice, I'm going to interrupt this for a very important announcement. People east of the fence have been observed today coming over the fence and looking at our cars in the parking lot. Please make sure that your doors are locked if you park in East Lot." I'm sure that's right out here. Oh, that's East Lot. Yeah, that's East. Yes, I'm getting the direction of the building. So thankfully we have a security force on hand doing that. So you see, here's a prime example. Lawlessness in the land. You know, people who try to take advantage of things. I don't know how I can work that into mercy and forgiveness just yet, but give me time. And so hopefully your car is locked and that sort of thing. But Paul is going to continue to check out there for us. "Your judgments are like light that goes forth, and I desire mercy and not sacrifice, and the knowledge of God more than burnt offerings. But like men, they transgress the covenant. They have dealt treacherously with me." Lack of mercy and forgiveness are cited as one of the reasons that Israel went into captivity. And it's certainly a problem in today's world as well. Again, I'm not advocating a soft-headed approach and just granting forgiveness to anybody, whether they have asked for it or not. People have to come to the point to where they're really sorry. But when that happens, what is our attitude towards them? And what should be our big-minded attitude even before they come to that point? You know, Christ said that we should pray for our enemies and those that despitefully use us. Do we do that as a Christian principle? Because that is what we're told to do. Long before Israel came to this point historically, mentioned here in Hosea, long before this ever happened, long before Israel even went into captivity or before there was even a nation that was formed, mercy and forgiveness made it possible for them to grow into nations. In Genesis chapter 45, you know, if you could ever make a case for somebody being upset at his family and holding a grudge, it would be Joseph. I mean, there is nobody that has a better case. There's no better example of somebody being righteously indignant and upset at anybody, much less his family, than Joseph. I don't know if there's anybody in the Bible that has a better case for holding a grudge. Do you? Yeah, I can't think of any outstanding example that is better than this one. But we know what happened to Joseph. He sold into slavery by his brothers, by his own family, and then goes through all of these horrendous trials, goes into prison, goes through these horrendous accusations and problems, and finally emerges out on the other side through God's hand and direct intervention, being the leader of Egypt and saving them from this horrible famine that would come on the land. And not only that, but other nations that surrounded. And so his brothers make their way, and we all know what happened, and how that was orchestrated was really beautiful. But in Genesis 45, his brothers, not even knowing who this individual was now, this grown man, then Joseph could not restrain himself before all those who stood by him. And he cried out, "Make everyone go out from me." So no one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians in the house of Pharaoh heard it. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Does my father still live?" But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed in his presence. And Joseph said to his brothers, "Please come near to me." So they came near. Then he said, "I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. But now do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years the famine has been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting, and God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth, and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So now it was not you who sent me here, but God. And God thought so much of this nation that wasn't even a nation yet, that he saved the most powerful nation on the earth at that time, Egypt. Was incredibly powerful and would be for many, many hundreds of years after this time. It would be the most powerful nation on earth, the virtual breadbasket of the known world at that particular time, with the most powerful river and the greatest population, the greatest productivity of any nation on the face of the earth. And he thought so much of his future people that he preserved that entire nation through a miraculous event. And Joseph was big-minded and forgiving, and his mercy made it possible for there to be 12 tribes. And that's why we sing of the 12 tribes of Israel and not the 2 tribes, Joseph and Manasseh. After the time of the resurrection, there was a fledgling church of God which was growing. And yet, and I don't know if we think about this that often, if you'll turn to Acts 7, the church of God was threatened with being absolutely wiped out. Turn to Acts 7 if you would. Because this is a part of the story that maybe we don't really look at enough, but here was a prominent member of the church, Stephen, who gave an inspired talk to a crowd who felt that he was blasphemous for looking up into the heavens and seeing the Son of Man. And he told them that at the end of his speech. And so they rushed at him, and they grabbed him, and they took him to the edge of town, probably threw him over a short cliff, and then they pounded him with stones. And that's how they did stoning. Usually wasn't by throwing stones at somebody standing there. It was, you know, dropping him over, and then just everybody dropping stones on top of him. And this account shows that Saul gave his blessing to his murder. In Acts chapter 8, it says in verse 1, "Now Saul was consenting to his death. And at that time a great persecution arose against the church which was at Jerusalem. And they were all scattered through the regions of Judea and Samaria except the apostles. And devout men carried Stephen to his burial and made great lamentation over him. As for Saul, he made havoc of the church, entering every house and dragging off men and women, committing them to prison." There was a big push to stamp out the church of God. There was a huge orchestration on the part of Saul to wipe this sect out. And we find out, of course, as you know, in Acts chapter 9, beginning in verse 1, that Saul, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest and asked letters from him to the synagogues of Damascus, so that if he found any of who were of the way, whether men or women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. So he was intent on wiping out the church of God. In its infancy, it was challenged with this most fundamental of Christian principles, as we're going to find out. In verse 13, of course, we know, I'm not reading you the parts, you know that Saul was struck down, God began to call him. And then Ananias answered, "Lord, I have heard from many about this man, how much harm he has done to your saints in Jerusalem. And here he has authority from the chief priest to bind all who call on your name." So, typically, I imagine, since it was the since it would be the order of the day to go to the synagogue and to worship, there would be many who were of this way who would go to the synagogue and who would worship. And if he found anybody, that was his job. That was he was protecting the truth, he supposed, from heresy. And so he was sending him off to be bound and to be executed in Jerusalem. But the Lord said to him, "Go, for he is a chosen vessel of mine to bear my name before the Gentiles, kings, and the children of Israel. And I will show him how many things he must suffer for my name's sake." Can you imagine how difficult it would have been to forgive and forget, to accept Paul as a brother in the faith? How hard would that be? To be like the most difficult thing if you had a brother or sister who had been bound in chains and taken to Jerusalem to be tried before the high priests, which undoubtedly some of them were, to have a real forgiving nature. You'd want to punch him in the mouth, first of all, wouldn't you? If you'll turn to Galatians chapter 1, Paul didn't cover up his problem and his difficulty. Galatians chapter 1 and verse 12, Paul speaks about how he was taught as an apostle, kind of like the rest of the apostles were taught in a very personal way, but by vision, apparently for 3.5 years, just as the original apostles were, in Arabia. Some people have speculated maybe it was down by the area of Petra, and that's possible. It's very possible. It was in Arabia, so that's down south of Jerusalem, and he was taken to a secluded space for a period of 3.5 years. And he said that of his teaching and training in Christianity, he said, I neither received it from man, nor was I taught it, but it came through the revelation of Jesus Christ. For you have heard of my former conduct in Judaism, how I persecuted the church of God beyond measure and tried to destroy it. And I advanced in Judaism beyond many of my contemporaries in my own nation, being much more exceedingly zealous for the traditions of my fathers. He was a Pharisee. He was part of that sect. And he understood the law of God perhaps better than anyone else. And this was... Oh, pardon me, lost my place. What were the results of his conversion? What were the results of the church's mercy and forgiveness of Paul? Turn to 2 Timothy. I want to go out on a very slight speculative limb here now. If you'll pardon me if I can just label it as a little bit of speculation. 2 Timothy 4 and verse 13, Paul was and had taken young Timothy under his wing, taught him how to be a minister, and he's now imprisoned and in Rome in house arrest. But he asked Timothy to bring the cloak that I left with Carpus at Troas when you come, and the books, especially the parchments. Now, this is the speculative limb, and you can look askance at me, but at least I'm labeling it. I'm not calling it doctrine. Was the book that we now know as the book of Hebrews among the parchments that Timothy was instructed to bring with him? You know, it may have been because it appears to be one of the last of the books that, well, while Paul's name is not attached to it, this may be the very reason that it wasn't attached to it. because maybe there was still some difficulty in the acceptance of Paul to the Hebrews. It's a book to the Hebrews. It was obviously written by somebody who had intimate knowledge of the traditions and the customs of the Hebrew people. Very obviously. So, you know, there are a lot of reasons that we have thought over the years that Paul wrote the book of Hebrews, even though nobody's name is attached to it. But the fact is this, Paul was called for many reasons. And one of those reasons was his natural ability and understanding of the Hebrew people. So when you go through the book of Hebrews and read through the topics, there was, in my view at any rate, and maybe the view of many others as well, there is no one else who could, in the latter part of the first century AD, continue to further the work of the church by helping people that had a background in Judaism to understand Jesus Christ. And that is what he does. I mean, we could go through it chapter by chapter by chapter. The author is showing that there was a Christ. There was a Christ that you have to have now at the center of your life. There is somebody that had the order of Melchizedek and divested himself of his godliness and became a human being, as this book describes, and helps people to understand that, and helps them to understand that, no, not all of those traditions that you learned as a child and from the time that you were a grown adult, are they all of nothing now? No, there is a purpose. All of those things were a shadow. They were a foreshadowing of what is to come, and it's all explained and tied up into a neat little bundle by understanding who and what Jesus Christ is, and that he's the high priest, not some man sitting in Jerusalem. He is the one to whom we go for consolation and help, as it says in Hebrews 4:13 and on. He is the one that can forgive sin, and we have to have that. And there would be nobody else better to understand the principle of forgiveness and mercy than Paul. Remember what Christ said. You know, whom would be forgiven the most? The one who has sinned a little bit or the one who has sinned a lot? Of course, the one who comes to the recognition that he sinned a lot, and that is throughout the epistles of Paul, one of the things that he makes abundantly clear, that he is not worthy, that he does not understand why he was even given this promise that he was given except to help others. So, while Paul's name is not attached to this book specifically, and this may be one of the reasons, because the message is more important than who wrote it. But I will submit to you this. It is my feeling deeply that forgiveness played a huge part in the preservation of this book to the Hebrews and its acceptance among the Jewish community and those that survived through the later stages of the first century AD, with its explanation to them specifically, whose lives had been shaped under what we call today the Old Covenant. A covenant that had no mercy, a covenant that was basically physical in nature. There was no forgiveness, there was no rational application of a spiritual nature under that Old Covenant. And who better to explain it than somebody that had lived and grown and understood and been inculcated at the feet of Gamaliel himself, the greatest teacher of the Jewish law and God's law at the time? Who better? I mean, it just doesn't make sense to say somebody else could have done it. James chapter 2 and verse 13 says, "For judgment is without mercy to the one who has shown no mercy." You know, that is just an application of a principle. If you do not extend mercy to others, then you will simply receive judgment. And you know what is said in Romans chapter 3 and verse 23? All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. All. So, if you're going to accept this premise that you want justice and judgment, then you choose death every time. And he concludes by saying, mercy triumphs over judgment. Mercy and forgiveness triumph over judgment. It's a really good reason not to hold in, as so many people do in this world today, hold in grudges and resentment and anger and hatred towards others. And it's certainly not Christian, but we have a tremendous, even personal motivation to understand mercy and forgiveness and to add it in abundance in our lives and extend it when we have the opportunity. Because if we can't do that at a time when we have been wronged, then we're not really following in the steps of Christ, are we? There are so many things that are taught in the book of Hebrews that relate to the experience of Jesus Christ for the people and help them. Had Paul not been accepted as a brother, then we might not even have the book of Hebrews preserved today. I submit to you that it was preserved because of mercy and forgiveness. Brethren, do you have the power to forgive? Can you put aside envy, hatreds, and the works of the flesh? Yes, you can. And if you do, you can shape and change history.